Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCPE
106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and I'm back again to entertain you. And so you probably turned the dial. Well, Mr. Martino, how's it going?
It's going great.
Listen,
back
I've been
in the saddle again.
Yeah, you haven't been here for a while. You've been off for a week and doing all your wife's housework. And
that's true. Yes.
Such a nice man you are. You know? I can't believe that. You know, vacuuming and dusting and doing the dishes and everything good. You know, but
my work is never done.
No, woman's work is never done, and I think she's going to get tired of you stretching her dresses out. I'm just saying, I just personally, she's never complained to me, but I'm just thinking that, you know, you're starting to stretch those out. Not saying that you gained too much weight, but.
No, that's true, I have.
But, you know, those pieces of deliveries are just starting to pack on.
Interesting. Contactless delivery.
Well, with you, how could it be? but, you know, I'm getting all these compliments about you. So people do like you, which is kind of strange. Yeah, they keep telling me that I'm picking on you too much. That, they're saying, why are you so mean to him? I said, wow. So, you know, I'm just sort of... I'm sort of in shock because I didn't realize I was picking on you. I'm picking on you too much, it seems to be. That.
This is all fun. This is...
They're upset that I'm being mean to you. It's like, well, you know what?
Well, thank you.
Then you can do...
It's all fun and games until someone loses an eye.
That's for sure.
Well, you know, then you can do the show and pick on me.
Ah,
no, that's fine. I just like, but so
you're the
so
boss. People,
yeah, well, I am, but you know, nobody seems to care about that now. I get pushed around anyway. So, and your reviews are doing good. Hey, people are pretty happy with that.
Excellent.
I don't know why, but you know. And anyway, so speaking of happy people, we've got the author of a new book coming out called Vamp Until Ready. Sounds like something down that you'd like, Dave.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
The author is James Magruder. Thank you for taking your time today to be here.
Thanks for having me, Alan and David.
Thank you.
So, where did it all start for you?
You mean my writing career or this particular book or...
Yeah, let's talk about your life.
My life.
No, where did it start? As in, okay, so, you know, with writers, I like to get into kind of who they are and kind of because something in your life initiates the time where you decide that you're going to write something and have people read it.
Absolutely.
That's sort of what I like to get to.
I can think of the moment. I was in sixth grade, and this is the Chicagoland, Chicago suburbs. And in English class, I had to write a paragraph based on a picture. It was a picture of like a Viking ship crossing the North Seas to maraud or pillage. And the paragraph I wrote was of such, I don't know, such high quality for a 11-year-old that my teacher, Miss Marcusilli, said to my parents, he's writing at a college age level. And so suddenly their eyes swiveled to me and started paying me some attention. I thought basically it was initially to get parental attention in a household situation that you could say was a culture of scarcity. There's that theory about, you know, in some homes it's like the siblings are all fighting for the emotional and financial resources of the parents. So that was the cauldron I was working in. And so I just started to think, it took years before I actually start to write, but that was when I knew, oh, I want to be a writer. And then, that was the formative experience, that paragraph about the Vikings.
Well, there you go. Okay, so that might have got you into it, but what was it that initiated the point of you going, well, I want to actually have something I've written be published?
Well, I think that goes kind of along with it. You know, in high school, we had the literary magazine, and I thought, well, I can get into that. And then actually, I would do, I don't know, I did as much theater in high school as anything else, and both for, I did musicals, which sort of really shows up in Vamp Until Ready. And I remember my high school teacher telling me, can you rewrite this ending to Fiddler on the Roof? There's a transition here that doesn't seem right, and we can't do it technically. So I said, sure, that's actionable. But there I was, 15, rewriting the ending of a venerated American classic musical. And then my senior year, we were doing Godspell, which is a lot loosey-goosey, and I was known as a writer at that point, so they had me rewrite some of the sketches in Godspell, and I drew heavily on my intense knowledge of Charlie's Angels, and which was very hot at the time, and Gone with the Wind. So I was thinking like my theatrical career, my adaptation career started in high school without my kind of even knowing it.
Well, I just wonder, who was your favorite angel?
Oh, my favorite angel. It was Jacqueline Smith, right? I wasn't going to go for the obvious. I wasn't going to go for Farrah. I can't even remember the third one, but Jacqueline Smith had the straight hair, right? Not the long, wavy stuff?
No, that's Kate Jackson.
Oh, then I like Kate Jackson best. She was the dykiest.
Yeah, that's exactly how I saw it.
Right.
But I wasn't going to say that. Right. I'm politically correct.
Oops, I'm sorry.
I'm the one that follows the rules.
Right.
What rules?
Well,
what rule book is that?
Yeah, hey, it's enough out of that.
My students, it's like, go ahead, I'm an adjunct. You can't cancel me. I don't need this job. You're lucky to have me. Old white man.
That's what I say that all the time, but nobody listens.
Right. So I'm an adjunct.
They say I'm picking on people. That's pretty interesting. But
it's still not what you want.
Well, no. Yeah, actually, no. let's go further. Did you like high school?
Oh yeah, I had a great time. I mean, I was like such a show queen, and I was like the last person to know I'd be a screaming queen. I developed a sense of humor early on because we moved around a lot and always had to make new friends. And my way of making friends was to be cruel about the weakest members of the herd. So, which is terrible. I regret it today. But that was my way to stay off the bottom of the food chain. And by junior and senior year, and I was, very driven, by the end of high school, all the brainiacs, we were just all in the same classes, and we started to give each other slack. This is the 70s, so I had a good time.
Yeah, yeah. The world's changed a lot since the 70s. I don't know if you've noticed. but I'm just, so when you look at the world today and you're publishing this new book today, do you feel like you have to change what you write or how you write it to fit the world today?
No, because as I alluded earlier, or before we actually started taping, at this point, I'm 60 years old. No one really cares what I have to say. And my previous three books, you can't say they burned down any houses, but they're very important to me. And I do have readers, and my stuff is very, so I don't temper or change things. And again, since my stuff always so far has occurred in the past, I don't have to worry about things like cell phones and the internet. And so I'm basically recuperating my past and settling scores with them's what, you know, gave me a pink belly in gym class. Now, you know, basically nobody really does want to hear, although a place like Rattling Good Yarns Press does. And there is a market out there for what I have to say. Now, if I were in my 20s writing for a younger audience, I would go lickety-split into a TV writing room. But I don't even have a television, which tells you, like, people say, you should write for TV. And I said, well, I'd have to buy one first, or, you know. and I also think that, you know, when I got, circling back to an earlier question, I got, let's say, serious about the writing, or writing in 1988. In 1988, I was given an HIV positive. I tested HIV positive. And I thought, wow. And in 1988, there were no drugs. It was a sure death sentence after a certain number of years. And so I thought, well, if I'm going to die, I have to push out a novel about what it all was about for me. And I wrote a first draft of a not good novel that has not been published in about 5 months. And so I think, but yes, dying to get published, because one of my fears until I did get published was that my great nephew, should I have one, would just come upon my boxes of manuscripts and say, gee, or my sister would say, yeah, your great uncle James was a writer, you know, and then they just pitch them, you know, there's that. Since I don't have children, it's like the books are my children.
Well, that's interesting. So they're very important to you. What is it you try to get across to people, to readers? What is it that you hope that they take away from your books?
Well, I think I want them to, again, it's, you could just say I write funny, sad, as I think a lot of queer writers do. I just want them, I mean, I don't make major, I mean, one of my books has underneath like a critique of Reaganomics and the cruelty, you know, that the untreated scourge or unacknowledged scourge that happened at the same time as HIV in the early 80s was the deregulation of capital gains on businesses. And that led to the era of greed, and it's just gotten worse and worse and worse. And now we are where we are because there's this other, the plague of greed. But that's as political as I get. I just, I like to take readers back to where I was, and hopefully they'll be entertained and moved when they're supposed to be. That's, you know, no one's ever asked me that before. I haven't given it much thought.
Now Vamp Until Ready. What made you write that? Like, what in particular got those words on the page?
Well, Vamp Until Ready, which is a Summerstock novel set in the 80s, that's my sweet spot, my 20s, my mixed up 20s, and all you had to do was buy me a Coca-Cola and call me cute, and I was yours for the night. I'd become a man of the theater, a critic, a librettist, a playwright. But I'd forgotten what it was like until I started writing Vamp Until Ready, how much fun it was to just be in the chorus, to just be 22 years old, and you wake up, and I got a show to do tonight. I mean, I wasn't very good. I wasn't very comfortable on stage. But I wanted to remember what that was like. And I wrote the first, the book's in five sections, and I wrote the first book very quickly, or the first section very quickly. And then I was giving myself, I was trying to stretch myself as a writer. And so I thought, let's write some straight women, because God knows they run the market. Let's try to expand my platform. I mean, they don't run the market, but they're the largest readership for literary fiction. But I didn't feel comfortable because, of course, the rules now are stay in your own lane. And I just didn't feel, because I'd written queer narrators, and but I thought, let's try to write some straight women and what they're about and what they, and so, and then I wrote, and I didn't want to write an entire novel with a straight woman protagonist and have it be horrible or sucky, and then it would be a waste of time. So I wrote long short stories or novellas. So by the time I wrote the second and the third parts of what became Vamp Until Ready, the characters started returning. So in a way, it's like a book of linked novellas or linked stories, like, well, not like Olive Kittredge, because that's a Pulitzer Prize winner, but along that way and the thing that holds it all together is Ithaca and the experience of doing work at a place called the Hangar Theater, which is still in operation today. It's a very long-winded answer, but I wanted to, I wanted to, it's a Valentine to what a wonderful, special place Ithaca, New York is. I hope you've been. If you haven't, you should visit. And also to the joys of putting on a show.
Well, how do you think your theater work has affected your fiction writing?
I think all these years on, when, because I also do like consulting for shows, you know, Aborning and musicals In Vitro, is I think that after 30 years working as a dramaturg, which is kind of like a story editor for playwrights, I think what my gift is story. And I didn't write fiction seriously until 2002, so I'm a late starter. But I, behind that, I'd had 15 years in the theater, and I know what makes a show work. And if you apply certain principles of playwriting to fiction writing, you have, in a way, you have a leg up. But it's not just the ability to write dialogue, it's the ability to write scenes. And, you know, because I'm not the kind of writer who could ever spend three pages discussing how beautiful the sky was or what somebody's face looked like. Because in the theater does it for you. You know, and I always feel, and it's even four books in, the sentences I hate to write are the ones like, you know, he opened the pack of cigarettes and lit a lucky strike. Or she crossed the room to answer the door. Because that's like, oh, that is like so boring. That is like, that's blocking. And in the theater, they do it for you. The director does it.
Yep.
And you don't have to say, oh, her pale oval face was framed by chestnut curls and her pertina. But the actress is that. So I'm completely free of writing that. And then, and like interior moods, like as you walk, you know. That's, unless it's a monologue on stage. So in a way, fiction is harder because you have to add those things. And yet I find it much harder. But I do find that my background in the theater has helped me shape a chapter, shape a scene. So within any given, like the five sections of Vamp Until Ready, each section has like 10 scenes in it. And I'm just very careful of the scene has to happen. Somebody has to want something, either get it or a stalemate. And then we want to know what. You know, that's a very long-winded way of saying I think I've gotten good at suspense because I've been in a theater without writing mysteries or thrillers.
And so your characters that you've got a as you call it a network of protagonists. Mm-hmm. So how do you create those characters? Like you've got Cary Dunkler, who was the boy turned masturbator or masturbator. and things like so each of these characters you've got in this network,
mm-hmm.
are they people you've worked with or you've been with before or something? How does that come to you?
Well, that's a great question, Alan. The first section with Cary Dunkler and his foster brother David and the theater director and the playwright, that's sort of a quartet of men, two older men, two younger men who are foster brothers. And when my first run of stories in 2002 to 2006 was basically I was 42 writing about my 22-year-old self making really stupid choices in the men I chose to sleep with. So it was kind of like a Hardy Boys mystery book. Like, why did I sleep with this guy? And so there was a bit of that left in Carrie Dunkler. But in Carrie Dunkler, there's, we mentioned his half-sister, and then he also works with a woman named Christy, and I just happened to throw in the detail that Christy was a mother of three, and they didn't have a lot of money, and she worked two jobs, and I didn't know how they kept it together. And so I finished the first one, and I said, well, I want to write straight women, so I started with Christy. And then Carrie appears in part two. It's not really his, but it's about Christy and then Issa, this a slutty Mary Poppins who upends this family by being their au pair one summer. And I'm sort of noodling around here, but like Carrie Dunkler and Gavin Steig, who runs the theater, they're in all of the sections. They either have starring roles, or they're mentioned, or they get a little scene. So the network just kind of got growing. And by the time I'd finished with the straight women, all three straight women had dated this sad sacky straight guy named Mark Shinner. And I thought, I want to write about him. Because if I'm extending myself writing straight women, I might as well throw a bone to heterosexual men. And I really enjoy, and again, I would never have known who Mark Shinner was. He just evolved and grew out of what had happened before. So it's both, there is a preordained, that would be Ithaca, that would be the theater, that every section would take place around a show. But then it just grows organically. And as I may have alluded to, what I'm most proud of with Vamp Until Ready is that I've made just about everybody up.
How do you get their development? So when you have a character and then they start going through things, how does that develop them as a personality?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking, I was saying like, oh, action and, use the theater. So the beginning of part two, this is Christy and her three daughters. And the very first line is Christy was in the middle of a double shift when her mother stroked out. So I present her. And the mother is lying at home four blocks away. She's dead. So that, like, the stakes are huge. And then I just took Christy home, and she's got the three daughters because I'd mentioned that before. And I just investigated what that would be like to encounter your dead mother. And then you have to call the cops. And then she's thinking about where to put the girl. And so, and then her first call then is to Carrie Dunkler, who we've seen in the first part. And so, I wouldn't say like it's a nice strategy to kill somebody to get the stakes going, but I just thought, let's just kill off the mother. So that was, and so I just thought about Christy. She's single. She's working two jobs. The money is tight. She's got, the three girls, each who's different, and like a very minor character, and the middle daughter in the end turns out to become a Hollywood starlet, and she sort of saves the day in part four. It's weird. I can't claim to have any scientific method for creating characters, but what was fun was that, okay, so I'll just roll with what I think this Christy woman is. And then she goes through changes in the rest of the book. She has sort of a bad end. Anyway, that was a bad answer, not a very good answer.
Have any of these characters, as you're developing them and you're creating them kind of organically, have they ever done anything that surprised you?
Oh, yeah. Like, all the time. They especially surprise me when I'm writing a play, because that old saw of, I just sit down and the characters talk to me is kind of true for theater. So it turns out that David, the foster Carrie's foster brother is very successful and goes to New York and works in ACT UP, turns out to have been a sex addict. And I couldn't have predicted that setting it out. But the fact that he is a sex addict really sends his brother into a tailspin. So, and then the beginning of the end is like that middle daughter who becomes a starlet says she just happens, you know, Parade magazine, that dope doofus thing they stick in every Sunday paper across the country. Well, you may not even read papers anymore, but I'm old school. But I little, and so little Darcy Schroyer does an interview, and she says, what's your favorite food? And she says, I love, when I want to break the bank calorie-wise, I want my old pal Carrie Dunkler's mint chocolate chip brownie and crustless quiche. So I thought, all right, that was a surprise that she got that Parade magazine interview because she wants publicity. And then, of course, then what happens is, because people actually, at least in 1992, still read newspapers and read Parade magazines, so Carrie is deluged with offers for recipes. Macy's calls them down to New York. They want to license his brownie, a tie-in with the movie star. And again, that is all just completely a surprise to me. But then when I think about it, when it's all over, oh, that made sense. That was kind of always there. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, I don't know if that's even any better of an answer. But
Is it difficult for you to write from being a playwright, let's say, to writing a book?
Yes. I think the hardest thing of all are short stories. I'm trying to finish some. As I said, playwriting has been much easier, but I also haven't had any legitimate success with my own original plays. And I think that's partly because this culture is shifting away and there are already too many old white gay male playwrights. Like, they're just stacked up ahead of me. No one, if anyone, they want to find the young queer playwright of color, and that's great because they're doing some amazing stuff. So I'm kind of out to pasture as a playwright, but I will work for hire on musicals. And again, if you've got a great director running the show, and I've been blessed to have my really good pal, Michael Mayer, who directed Spring Awakening and Green Day's The American Idiot and developed them for, and the Adam Driver. Is his name Adam Driver?
I think so.
Yeah. Adam Driver just did a Burn This revival. He's a very, very busy director and a good, and so if you have a director in hand who can edit for you, it's just, you're just writing for, because a libretto for a musical, it's like you're writing in chunky crayons because it's all about getting to the song, writing just the right launch. There's a lot of craft to it, but you can't say it's like Proust. Proust could never succeed as a book writer on a musical. So in a way, there's more play writing as in wrought in writing a musical, and I'll do that for money because the commercial theater at the moment doesn't care what color you are or how old you are. So I feel very at ease writing music and knowing that it will change 500 times. And again, I've had two musicals on board.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Broadway, where the heat is on you if they're not laughing at what you thought was going to be a joke. Two nights in a row where it lies there, you've got to write a new one. So you can't get precious. You can't get precious about playwriting or musical writing because the audience will tell you if it stinks. The audience will let you know when they're bored. You hear those programs rustling. You know, you can't tell with a reader of a book. They could just skip over. And the other lesson about writing for theater is that the audience is only going to hear it once. They can't go back and reread where they can't, oh, I didn't get that paragraph or that sentence kind of threw me. It's just going by and it's all happening now. So they're very related media, but they also have their advantages and disadvantages. And the biggest disadvantage of maybe playwriting is you have to count on an audience, a paying audience, and they're hard to get.
Yeah.
And they're never, each individual audience member is wrong with their criticisms, but as a collective, they're always right, Harold Clurman once said.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder, but, you know, because when you're doing a live play or there's a stage performance, you're getting that reaction immediately. You're getting that reaction as it happens,
yeah,
to what you're doing, whereas in a book, you're not.
Yeah.
Right? It takes longer. But with nowadays, with all of the social media, which you avoid, obviously, people can interact with your book much quicker now.
Yes.
But that's obviously, but you stay away from that.
Well, again, it's not a moral stance. It's more like...
No. I wasn't saying that, but
yeah,
you yourself right now, up to now, haven't really jumped on that social media bandwagon, so to speak, so you're not really aware of what they're saying about you too much.
Yeah.
On that.
I was on Facebook for like 7 or 8 years. I got on it when my first novel was published, and I got off it in April of 2018 because on Head Over Heels, the Go-Go's musical, I co-wrote. The original writer who left the project or was made to leave the project, in his Facebook post compared me to a tick on his dick. And that was, he said, it's April and that's parasite season. You know what that means. I have to look out for ticks. And I find myself this week with the biggest tick on my dick ever. I mean, legally wasn't allowed to use my name, but there was a picture of me because our show was crying out in San Francisco. And that was bad enough, but it was like all the people who were like chiming in who knew nothing of the circumstances. Like, yeah, Magruder should die. We're an asshole. Death to parasites. And it's like, I've gotten a lot of bad reviews in my day, but who knew that an ad hominem attack would take me down? So I just left. And I don't regret, because I spent a lot of time on board. And again, I don't need new things to get me angry. You know, 4 years of Trump was enough. Anyway, but with Vampire Already, the book is just hitting people's hands. It's going to take a few weeks for anybody to post a review on Amazon or Goodreads, or my friends will get back to me. And I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, it's not instant. It's not like tonight's episode of Scrubs. Listen to me, I'm dating myself. Tonight's episode of the Car 54, Where Are You?
Yeah.
Is really the bomb. It's really Ginchy. It's like that. There's none of that instant turnaround, and I think that's for the good for books.
Yeah, I guess it is. It's certainly different. I think that I know what you mean by being called a dick. You know, a tick on a dick. I mean, I have never been called that, but I've been called a lot of other colorful things. But I think you have to grow kind of a hard shell to get through today's social media.
Yeah, and like there are like Broadway chat rooms, and I've been talking to them because I think there's such a theatrical tie-in with Vampins Already, and I told the woman who runs Talkin' Broadway, which I've been lurking for years, because if I stopped lurking and started weighing in, I wouldn't do anything else, because I'm a man of vicious opinions, and it'd be the same thing. I'm really glad I was off Facebook for the Biden-Trump election season. Because you can just get lost in the hate, and you add to the hate. And I'd be happy to add to the hate because it's my hate, and my hate is right. And all of you people who aren't vaccinated, you should die sooner rather than later. You're
oh my,
idiots.
Oh,
I mean, are freaking idiots. But I don't want, I don't want that to be me, that Mr. Spleen all the time. I have to keep it in check or I'm impossible to live with.
Well, I think it just has to be separate. Like as far as my social media, when I run through it, if anybody's a like Trump or they're really into that whole sort of thing, I just don't let them in my circle.
Right.
And then I don't. And even if they're a pro, really far left and far right, just doesn't matter if they're doing 24/7 of nothing but politics on their site. I really don't want to be a part of that.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Not that I agree, you know.
But I'm sure, Alan, you've discovered you find out that everyone you went to high school with is Republican, and you just have to talk back. It's like, I thought you were a reasonable person.
Yeah. Well, no, the thing is, I think what I've done is I've done that. I went down that road back in the Hillary Clinton, Trump time, 16. And so then I realized as I pulled back that that's not what my social media is going to be for. Yeah. So I've kind of drifted away from that, because you're right, you can get so wrapped up in it and get into so much trouble and so many fights that it's not really worth the time. No. That's all. It's just because nothing gets accomplished.
But it's instantaneous. You get to go into that, like, blah, and then calm down, blah, all the time. And, you know, that's an emotional jolt. And some people have less than interesting lives. That's why they turn to Facebook.
Well, that's sort of what I mean. I don't think it's that. It doesn't really accomplish much, because at the end of the day, you don't know who you're yelling at even, or if they really care about what they're saying, or if they're saying it just to create some sort of drama, you know? So I kind of shy away from that now. I get enough of it here at the radio station that I'm happy. You know, so that's, how does that affect a writer like you? All of this stuff going on in the world, because for me, I think the whole Trump and this whole last little 5 years or so, whatever it's been, all the stuff going on in the U.S., I sort of feel that it's kind of took me by surprise, and it's kind of upsetting that so many people were on board with this whole thing. But with all of that going on, when you're sitting there trying to put together like Vamp Until Ready while all this is going on, plus a pandemic and protesters and anti-maskers and all this stuff going on, does that affect your writing?
Yeah, I mean, it can. It's like, I just do my, I mean, I wish I had, as they say, a better practice where I would get up and write for 3.5 hours, but, and that would be wonderful, and maybe I will one day grow into that, but I think it helps that I don't have a television. Or, you know, I mean, I know, like, the literal idiot box is not, I mean, I could be on a constant news feed via my laptop, but I choose not to, partly because I don't know where to go. I mean, when I'll look at the New York Times, I'll look at Huffington Post, I'll look at, the Washington Post has a firewall, and I'll look at CNN a few times a day. And that's kind of how I stay. And I also get, I have a subscription to The Economist, which is like punishment, especially when you fall behind. I know way too much about China and Burkina Faso at the moment than I ever knew before. But with all the noise out there, I actually think it's wonderful to be 60. And it's wonderful to have spent half of my life not on the internet. Because I know how to be quiet and still and to listen, because that's what I need to do to write, is to just to get in the zone where you're listening and building a world sort of, that's all I can think of.
Yeah, well, I just wonder if because I would imagine as a playwright, a lot of the social unrest that goes on around you, or even the personal unrest, you absorb and you put that into your play in one way or another. So I wonder if it's the same for you with your books.
Well, as I said, I'm still, and again, I'm kind of through with the autobiographical stuff. But I really was, when I started writing fiction, and it was, first, why did I sleep with that person? Or, like, my first book is about when I was 16 and my mother found Jesus and I found out I was queer, and I became obsessed with Broadway musicals. And then, you know, in Vamp Until, I'm actually not sure what my next book will be, if I have another, if I have another novel in me, but if I do, I want to make sure that it's contemporary. Because all the fiction I've published, none of it, with one exception, has happened after 2005. I'm still like digging into the past and trying to make sense of situations and people. And again, but then people say, well, why don't you write a memoir? And it's like, well, I'm not interested. I need the out. I need the out to make something up, to make something better. I need to have room for surprise. I don't want to control the narrative that much, I find.
Well, after writing fiction or plays, do you do anything in between to decompress or recharge?
I was just going to try to think, what is that slim fast thing? A shake at breakfast, a shake at lunch, and a healthy meal at night. No, actually, I just got off the hardest thing I will ever do, which is I spent 5 years writing a long book of nonfiction on commission. It was a money job that turned into a labor of love. And it's going to come out next year, and it's a book about the first 50 years of Yale Repertory Theater. Because I went to Yale, the drama school, and I've taught there, and I interviewed 130 people, and you know, as blousy and gregarious as I sound in this interview, I actually don't want to call strangers on the phone and talk to them. So I really admire that, Alan David, you can just be free to talk to anybody. But I had to stick to a truth. And I think the charge in this instance with the nonfiction to be faithful, fair, and write good sentences really slowed me down. I don't ever want to do that again. You could say that was I don't do anything really but write and play with the cats, and you know, I cook a little. But I'd be a busier man if I were younger, because I would try to be doing the television thing.
Yale, is that like a college or something?
Oh, it's this dump in the middle of Connecticut, in the shadow of Quinnipiac College, just down the road.
Oh. So you do what you have to.
Right.
You know, you,
I worked hard for the money.
Yeah, so hard for it.
Huh? Yeah.
If someone's never heard of you before, they're listening now, and they go, this guy sounds kind of interesting, and they were to buy one book, what book of yours would you suggest to them?
I think it would be Vampits Already. It's sort of it's the most inclusive, you could say. It's not filled with intergenerational gay sex, for example.
And where's the cock?
Right. I know. And Love Slaves of Helen Hadley Hall, which I wrote, it took 20 years to write and publish. It's set at Yale, and it's written in such a highfalutin tone. It would just put you off. Sugarless is wonderful because it's a coming of age story, and teenage problems are always, But Vampits Already, I mean, the significance of the title for me, the book was originally, and for years was, I thought of it as called Save Yourself, because all of this network, these five or six characters, their lives get saved just by working backstage or on stage. But a lesbian memoir came out just last year called Save Yourself. So I had to scram, because Save Yourself is a theater axiom where if everything else is,
oh my,
up on stage, what do? Save yourself. So I was looking for something else that would kind of describe waiting for your life to begin in a way. And so that was, so I was thinking of, and so Vampits Already, these characters are all, things happen to them by being affiliated with each other and the theater that lets them start their lives or find out what their lives could be about. So it's a very hopeful book, and although there are a couple of deaths in it, I think it ends happily. I mean, it's hard for me to write a happy ending. My My happiest short story ending involved my getting gonorrhea in Paris in 1980. That was the happy ending. So I guess Vamp, just because it's the most inclusive and, you know, straight people are in it and people like, people, you know, after Glee and everything and all these competitive TV shows, people like backstage. I think there's been a resurgence of interest in backstage stories.
Hmm. And is French gonorrhea different than American gonorrhea?
Well, it's called le ch'tuille, which means the tickle. But I think in every language or every culture, oh my God, you know, here's the rosé talking. Well, I don't know if either of you gentlemen have ever been checked out for gonorrhea, but there's this little wire thing with a swab at the end. And they just put it up there. And I quote myself, they wiggle it around like an uncooperative car key. And they pull it out and then put it on a petri, you know. And so, yeah. But that's in my book, Let Me See It. It actually does have a happy ending.
So to speak.
Not
the massage parlor.
Happened. Right, not that.
No. Well, I'm afraid to ask, but who are your biggest influences, whether they're writers or performers or singers or dancers or doctors?
Alcibiades, Goethe, and Shakespeare. And some of these books are getting canceled, and I can see why. Like, I don't know if you've ever read A Confederacy of Dunces by John Kennedy Toole, posthumously published and won the Pulitzer. That is just a gold mine of American comedy. That's a huge influence. There's a Herman Wouk who died at 104 last year. Who knew? He lived that long. Forgotten, but not gone. He, before he became like a mass market novelist, he published a book about his childhood in the 20s called The City Boy or The Adventures of Herbie Bookbinder. And I found that in a library in middle school. And I was just instantly hooked. And I've read it maybe 15 times since I was 12. And now when I read it, it's like, oh my God, I feel like that book has just seeped into my consciousness and my sentences. So that is an influence that I can't say I'm completely proud of because it's not Tolstoy or Jane Austen. It's this mass market. But I love Dawn Powell, who is a forgotten, now she's not forgotten, American comic novelist. I veer towards the comedy. And you might say, like, what do I do when I'm not writing? I'm still a voracious reader. And for example, if I'm not reading my friends' books, I just go back to classics. And during COVID, once I could finally read again, it took a while, I reread Anna Karenina, which I hadn't read since I was 23. And I was too young to read it then. I was just reading for story. But now, all these years later, having been a writer myself, and writers voted as the greatest novel ever, by page 10, I said, yep, this is the real deal in ways I couldn't have imagined or appreciated at 23. So I'm not going to say Anna Karenina is an influence. I was just going off on a tangent that there's a lot to be said for rereading books. There are also books you go back to and it's like, wow, that's really for teenagers. That's the time to read it.
But I wonder if that also happens when you go back and reread your own writing. If you look back at some of your older work, do you ever kind of look and kind of go, wow, I would do it differently now?
Yes. That novel that I wrote that was unpublished when I thought I was going to die, I like reread a few chapters. I was like, oh my God. Obviously the person can write, but he's so psychologically defended that it's a really hard read. But, you know, I think, you know, these new stories I'm working on are much looser. And they're actually, a lot of them are set in the present. And I think I told you that the tongue-in-cheek title of the next book of stories is going to be called No One's Looking at You, which is a tongue-in-cheek way of describing my position as an old white queer in America. I mean, women have experienced like being invisible after the age of 40 for decades, but white guys, it's new to us, and it hurts.
Well, yeah. very painful.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm further along in my thinking about it than Mitch McConnell. Who, when he dies, should be buried between Justice Scalia and Phyllis Schlafly.
Oh, it's a world. So, listen, how do people get a hold of you then? You're not on social media, or where do you hang out in Grindr? Like, where do people find out about you and your books? And
God, you know, now you can make me think I need to revive my website. I had a website. It didn't look like anybody ever went there. somebody created a wiki page for me, whoever that is, and it wasn't my mother, because she once asked me, is the internet open on the weekends? you're making me think I should actually, that there are people who are going to want to buy this book. So thank you for this interview.
Well, of course. I mean,
Amazon or Goodreads, you know, just if you know how to spell my name, you can find me.
Yeah. Well, we'll do the best we can.
Well,
on
thank
our website.
You.
maybe, you know, if you have a phone number or something, we can put it out.
Oh, well, that too. And, you know, it's like that episode of Modern Family where he gets the thing on the side of the truck where he basically says his wife is great for a happy ending. Speaking of happy endings. There's no such thing as bad publicity. Right.
Well, that's what they say, unless you have to live through it.
Right.
You know.
Pick on a dick.
Yeah. Hey, but I wonder, you know, when you say that things, like, I just wonder if things will influence you with these past few years, like with the pandemic and stuff, and it gets into your writing without you knowing it.
Well, we'll see, but I found out that I kind of still need 20 years to figure out. I need 20 years of a low, low simmer. To figure it out, because these news stories, No One's Looking at You, they actually are dealing with my life that started 20 years ago, and I met my husband. So I'm moving into the 21st century. So if I'm alive 20 years from now, you can expect my amazing COVID novel long after everyone's forgotten what it is or was.
Does it make you feel a little bit vulnerable when you write about a lot of things in your own life that you went through?
No. You know, I'm a natural ham and an exhibitionist. I mean, and in personal interactions and kinds of friends I make and meet and hang on to, you get to be my age, it's like there's no time for small talk. There's no time for just shooting the shit.
Oh, my.
It's like time really is all we have. So I just want to, if I'm writing about myself, it's an act of recuperation and kind of analysis, but also I'm just putting it out there. I suppose, you know, if I had children, I would feel differently. I might not even be a writer, but it's like this was me. And me was honest and me was funny/sad.
Oh, pretty interesting. Pretty interesting conversation here. So we'll have pictures up later for everyone.
Okay.
And, you know, they can...
Yes, that is my real hair. I always tell my student, that is my real hair, and I was not convicted of that charge.
No.
But I can't... No. But Indiana wants me. Lord, I can't go back there.
No.
Oh, God, you guys don't know that song. You're so young. Indiana wants me, Lord, I can't go back there.
Yeah, well, we're youngins, you know.
That's the Rosé singing.
I'm only 22, so I don't know anything about that stuff. So, well, wow, what a conversation. So we've learned a lot.
I hope, as they say on eBay, item as described.
Yeah. Well, actually, we've learned a lot. Mr. French Gonorrhea. And
right, Trump French Gonorrhea. It's a funny story.
Yeah, I bet. until you got the knife
right,
down
right.
there, you know. Yeah. But, wow, interesting. Well, I appreciate you taking the time. Now, well, the book we're featuring.
Thank you so much, Alan and David. Now you're going to make me think, like, how can I become a media whore in the next 20 days? Not going to happen.
Type like David. Please, just get on it, you know.
Right. Gentlemen, have a great day.
Well, thank you. And again, let's talk about your book. It's called Vamp Until Ready. Our guest is James Magruder, and we appreciate you being here.
Thanks.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll say it!
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.